Good morning. Thank you all for coming to this gathering, this motley crew of folks that all went to Greece so that we can talk a little bit about our experience there. Today's session is just sort of setting up the conversation for the next 2 weeks. So we're really here today to get on board with, why does the church do mission? Why go on mission trips? What is mission in particular? And so I'm going to kind of trace through a little bit of history. It's not meant to be a church history lesson. I'm not a church historian. But just to kind of say where the church has been in terms of mission and how we got to where we are now, how it's perceived in the world now. And by way of just kind of bringing ourselves into the room, I thought I'd ask everyone to kind of think for a second. What are some of the groups that you belong to in your life? Just name some. Groups of other people that you belong to. Yes, Hunter.
Middle school teachers.
Being a group of middle school teachers together, community of a work community.
Choir.
Yes, and various groups here at church that you can serve through. That's right. Supper clubs, good one. Rotary club. I was thinking even more basic like that, like family, you know, belonging to family, right? We have circles of friends. Like I have my circle of friends from high school, my circle of friends from college, my circle of friends now, all of that very different. I want us to think a little bit about how each of those circles of friends are sort of our tribes that we belong to. Much in the way that if you belong to a tribe, there's certain things that that tribe asks of you, where you are called upon to act a certain way, give a certain way, participate a certain way in your own tribe. You have some expertise to offer, some sense of commiseration to offer of what your life is like. And that tribe asks something of you to do with yourself. Think a little bit about your faith, the tribe of your faith, the people that you belong to here at St. Paul's, and also in the Church Universal, the capital C Church. I often get stuck in my faith, and I'm always kind of saying, what is it that you're asking of me, God? And the thing that I always kind of come back to is this phrase from Micah. Micah is one of the later prophets in the Old Testament, and he said, what does the Lord require of you? To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. This is a verse of scripture that I go back to every time I feel a little stuck, every time I feel a little adrift in understanding what my job is in belonging to the tribe of the Christian faith. It really simplifies this perspective, really kind of brings in full relief what we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to do with our faith. Three things: do justice, love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So let's talk a little bit about where the church has been in, how am I going to do this? I'm going to put this up here. How the church started and how the tribe of disciples figured out what it was that they were supposed to do, what their mission was. So it all starts there in Israel, vaguely. That Jesus called his disciples simply by saying, come and follow me. Come and follow me and see what I do, do what I do, you know, mirror me, emulate me. And their community is grounded in friendship more than anything else. In the Gospel of John, Jesus says to his disciples at that Last Supper, I have called you friends. And so that's the basis of their relationship, is friendship and relationship and love. And when Jesus is crucified, dies, and is ascended to heaven, the disciples are left with, what do we do next? What does our community mean? What is this tribe doing? And at the end of Matthew, Jesus left them with a little bit of instruction about what their job was. This is called the Great Commission. Jesus said, go therefore into the world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. So the disciples' job to do was to spread the faith, and to do so by bringing people into the tribe, bringing them in by way of baptism and also obedience to Jesus's teachings. So that's how, and starting in Acts, that's how the disciples do that work of setting up those communities, is they go into towns and they preach and they teach and they build relationships with people, and a few people decide that what they are talking about is pretty cool, and they decide to get baptized. That's how the church starts to grow after Jesus ascends to heaven. So from its very beginnings, church mission means building communities of faith. It means drawing people into the tribe. And for the early church, these are the first few centuries, first and second centuries, the church is very small. They meet in houses, really. They're, seen as a community that is going to be self-supporting, so they are completely autonomous. And they deal with a great deal of persecution. This is what was going on in these first few centuries. There was a lot of fear directed at Christians. If they were found to be Christians, they were going to be executed. So that's why they had to meet in secret. And later, and again, this is not meant to be an overview of church history, but you get to 315, and the conversion of the Emperor Constantine changed everything. So for the first 300 years of the church's life, being a Christian was something that you really did because you felt compelled to, because of a personal reason. You were compelled by preaching. You were compelled by the sacrament. You wanted to belong to the tribe, and you were willing to sacrifice anything to belong to it. When this emperor was converted to Christianity, it changed everything. He demanded that not only his entire household be baptized and become Christian, but that his entire kingdom become Christian. So what was once clandestine and in the closet and hidden was brought out into the light and said, it's okay to be a Christian. You're not going to be killed. You're not going to be tortured. You're not going to be imprisoned. We're going to make it okay and turn it into the state religion. Completely changed everything. But what that meant, and you get into the Roman Empire, now everyone is a Christian, but everyone has to be a Christian. So mission, where the church grew before that time by little small communities, by word of mouth, by relationship, now Christianity is being spread by coercion, being made to be a Christian. There were plenty of other ways that the church spread at this time that were positive and that were good, and God works through many channels, I think, for his church to grow in the world. One of them is the wave of monasticism that happened in the subsequent centuries. Monastics went out into countries beyond Italy and created parish churches, had a sense of not just building a monastery for their own priests to function in, but they were serving the people of the town. They were allowing for worship to happen, and by that, sacraments and community coming together to have a priest celebrate the sacraments. They did that everywhere, and you see ruins of some of these churches and monasteries all over the British Empire, all over France and Spain. But it still has this kind of influence of when a monk goes into a community or when a priest is sent into a community as a missionary, they bring with them the Roman Catholic Church, which is the Mass is going to be said in Latin because that's the voice of God. We're not going to learn your language. We're not going to get to know your community. We're going to bring the church to you and make it happen here in this little small town in Northumbria. That's an influence that is a big part of church mission, is that the church is really there in Italy, in Rome, and it goes out to the surrounding areas. You also have something to consider when we think about the formation of mission is the influence of violence and the way in which our tribes and our identities have to do with what nation we belong to and what that nation has to say about other nations. And when we get to 1095, the temperature had reached the boiling point in terms of Christian and Islam relations. The Islamic community had largely been in sort of the Palestinian area for centuries and occupying all of these areas. And Christians came in and sort of said, no, we want your buildings and we want your space. And we want, more importantly, this land. We want the holy land where Jesus actually walked to be ours, to belong to Christian people. And so all of these crusaders came to this area and killed as many Muslims as they could find and took over their sacred buildings and turned them into churches. It was a horrible, terrible period of lots and lots of violence. And this is an element that lingers today of what mission looks like. It looks like violence. It looks like coming in and not only saying, you have to speak my language and you have to wear the funny vestments and you have to do worship this way, but you have to give up your land. You have to allow us to come into a space and own it. We also have in 1622, I just want to make mention of this. This isn't a timeline. But later in 1622 is the first statement coming from the Pope in Rome about what mission was going to be, what the identity of mission was. He issued this statement that's called the Sacred Congregation for the Propagation of Faith. And really what it meant was we are now defining what exactly mission is, what growing the church looks like. And it looks like going to places that are without Christians and setting up Christian communities. So that's just a little bit of an overview of the influence from Rome. Let's look at the influence from the British Empire. Again, church belonging, belonging to the Christian tribe, meant for this particular part of the history is tied to national identity. It's tied to who is in charge, and the king says that we're supposed to be Christians, so we're gonna be Christians. And again, I'm not going to get into all of the history of how the British Empire set up, had a relationship with all of the churches in Rome, had Roman churches built in the British Empire, and then became separate from and set up the Anglican Communion. That's a whole nother class. But just to say that this church was built in such a way that and it's something that we deal with now as Americans, that whoever is in charge, whatever their faith is, it influences what we are, what we choose, what our faith is. That's how the church history was with belonging tied to national identity. Later on, much later, you have the Reformation, and there's not a lot of interest in growing and building new churches. Mission just sort of like takes a nap for a little while. But there is a formation of a couple of different societies, the Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge and the Church Missionary Society. These two institutions still exist today. The SPCK is founded, is based in at Sewanee for the American branch. And both of these institutions are much like the Roman Catholic edict that went out, they make statements about what mission is and what mission isn't. And in recent years, these institutions look at the work of sending missionaries from a church, but also the work. Are we going to go and provide for the needs of the people that are in the town that we go to? The Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge now is largely about education, about book publishing, about sending Bibles to places that need Bibles in the language that they need. So anyway, these institutions exist for some of that purpose. Skipping ahead to the Church of England as it's in the colonies and as gradually the Episcopal Church is formed as we break away from not only England but the Church of England. It still is about allegiance. It's about national allegiance, finding grounding in where you are. This is our land. These are our people. This is our faith. So as the Episcopal Church forms, They also establish a church-wide missionary society, and they have specific bishops that are ordained just to go out and build new churches. They're not ordained to have a diocese and stay in the colonies. They're sent out to lots and lots of different countries. In the 19th century, there is a lot of interest. This is not just happening in the Episcopal Church, but there's a lot of interest in going out to missions in Latin America and Liberia and in other African nations. So I'm just going to touch very briefly on those missions. You still have this lingering rhetoric that was coming from the Church of England in colonialism, where church missionaries, these bishops that would go and set up churches, had this rhetoric of, we're going to go civilize the natives. We're going to go into their small communities, their kind of primitive culture, and we're going to try and tame them, which is a horrible way to say that, but that's really the mentality, in order for them to have access to the gospel, in order for them to know and love Jesus. They have to be like me. They have to perceive the world like me. They have to identify their problems in light of the way that I understand the gospel. So it's a little backward. It's a little bit off at this point, but it lingers still. In Latin America and in South America, these missionary bishops are also experiencing incredible poverty in a way that they really start to see. There's the inkling of getting away from civilizing the natives and more of, we need to help them. We need to come in and allow for some infrastructure to be set up for them to have access to things like food and growing their own crops and having their own livestock and healthcare and eventually education before we can even do that work. So they're coming to terms with what civilizing the natives really means in these centuries. Also happening in Africa after the Civil War, the American Colonization Society in 1816 was responsible for being a part of helping freed slaves return home. And so there's all this awareness in the United States of the needs of these people in Africa and just Africa as a continent, as a place of great need. So some of these missional bishops at the same time were sent to establish churches. And in those, you know, first years, and I think even lingering to contemporary time, there's this mindset of they are the heathens, they are the other, they are the foreigners that need to be civilized before they'll have access to the knowledge that we have. So this kind of persisting converting the heathens is still a part of church mission. But we get to the 20th century, and church mission starts to look inward, starts to look a little bit about maybe we should be a little self-critical at this point. And maybe our work in going to all these areas needs to be about doing the work of establishing schools, libraries, hospitals, you know, going into places and building homes and improving economies. This is the era when you start to see social agencies arise. And the missionaries struggle with three things while they are there in this process. There's this lingering colonialist baggage that we're moving away from this sense that we need to come in and civilize the natives, and instead we need to come and fix their problems. But I feel kind of like Santa Claus. I feel a little bit like I've got something figured out and they don't, and I'm coming in a kind of condescending posture. They struggle with that. They also struggle with the reality of getting to know a new community in a completely different nation, a completely different world, means that they're exposed to different religions, that the practicing religion of those local communities is really a voice that they have to speak out almost against, and then they discover they have to speak with. And so some of the theology of a missionary is often to come into an area and to learn a lot about the particular religion of the people and to integrate it with Christian beliefs. A good example of this is my friend Lauren Stanley, who some of you know. She is an Episcopal priest who is a missionary in South Dakota in an Indian reservation, the Rosebud Reservation. And when she was first hired, she's been a missionary all over the world. This particular job, she was hired, and there are many things about the local Indian culture that involve religious ritual, that involve Native American ceremonies and rituals. The sun dance, for example, is this big event that the community is a part of. Lauren couldn't come into that community and say, that's of the devil. You have to do your Christian-y thing with me. She had to find a way for those two things to be able to speak to each other. And if you ever attend one of the Eucharists at her churches, she will use that language. She will try to integrate the different ways that faith is perceived and experienced both in the Christian narrative and in indigenous Native American practice. The other thing I want to talk about a little bit is liberation theology, and I'm not going to be able to sum this up in the time that I have, but the liberation theology is essentially a theology that comes out of the South American areas. The kind of lead voice is this guy named Gustavo Gutierrez, who writes a book about liberation theology that makes the claim that God might actually not only be here ahead of us in the people that we are serving, but that God might want to go there first. That God loves everybody, God loves the whole world, God is with us, but that God might prefer to be with the poor first. That God attends to the needs of the poor first before anything else. There's way more to say about liberation theology. I just want to lift it up as something that is part of the issues that missionaries are struggling with. So, as a working definition of what we have with that like whirlwind tour of history and where mission has been throughout the Christian centuries, here's where we are now in the Episcopal Church. Partnership, not paternalism. Any mission is still about evangelism. We still care about building new churches. That's important. That's something that absolutely needs to happen. But we're no longer just going to communities and dropping down a church and expecting the native people to be a part of it in the way that we want to. We want the communities to be able to self-theologize in their current context, that they're able to name and articulate God in their own way that makes sense to them, that maybe even integrates different beliefs, different ways of being in community. Mission is also local. That's one of the primary things that we sort of have to talk about. We do mission here at St. Paul's all the time, to Winston-Salem, to people just down the road from us. And that it happens at home just as much as in faraway countries. Mission is also global, so we are caring about people that we've never met, that are in countries halfway across the world, that when they suffer, we suffer. We understand that we belong to each other in the church. And then finally, that mission is also personal. We go into mission because of our own need as Christians to grow and to expand our hearts, to be changed. And that, I don't want to leave that sounding selfish, like I'm going for my own personal need. But our faith requires us to change and to grow. And we only do that when we get outside of ourselves. When we move beyond our own community, our own way of seeing the world, we expand our hearts. And so mission, when we do the work of understanding people's stories, to help with their problems, to help heal, and to forge and build relationships, we grow closer to God. So, with that whirlwind overview, here we are at St. Paul's. And we find ourselves in a time and a place where we understand that there's great need in the world. There are all sorts of problems and wars going on right now. There's a lot of people in need. How do we siphon down and figure out where to go first? We, and Sally and I have been in conversation quite a bit about how it all kind of came about, and she was sharing with me that the initial, like, first drops of why should we go to Greece came from St. Paul's going and sending money to some of these different programs that were sending, it was diapers and formula and things like that that went to Greece in the refugee crisis that was happening around like 2015 or so, 2016. That was the first, like, we sent a check. And Sally, as our outreach director, continued to read and to learn about this crisis and about what was happening there, and also had contact with Woody Faircloth, who was volunteering for a backpack program. Carry the Future, that's right, and also had been volunteering with Allied Aid, which is the agency that we ended up working with. So I draw attention to this, not to put Sally on the spot, but to say this is how mission starts for a community. One person and one kind of community takes stock of everything that there is to do. There's so much need. There's so many things we could do. And gets passionate about it and starts talking to other people, starts drawing in relationships and saying, maybe we should join together. Maybe we should go over there. Maybe we should work this out. And that's how it grows. That's how the church grows, is by relationship. I do want to do a little bit of education about the refugee crisis in Greece, but I am not an expert in these matters, and so I thought I would play this video. This was done in 2015, so it's a little dated. The numbers are not quite right, but it gives a good overview of what happened in Greece and what was happening in the EU with refugees, and I hope everyone can hear it.
In the summer of 2015, Europe experienced the highest influx of refugees.
Can you hear it?
Why? The main reason is that Syria has become the world's top source of refugees. Syria is located in the Middle East, an ancient, fertile land settled for at least 10,000 years. Since the 1960s, it's been led by the Al-Assad family, who have ruled it as quasi-dictators until the Arab Spring happened in 2011, a revolutionary wave, protests and conflicts in the Arab world that toppled many authoritarian regimes. But the Assads refused to step down and started a brutal civil war. Different ethnicities and religious groups fought each other in changing coalitions. ISIS, a militaristic jihadist group, used the opportunity and entered the chaos with the goal to build a totalitarian Islamic caliphate. Very quickly, it became one of the most violent and successful extremist organizations on Earth. All sides committed horrible war crimes using chemical weapons, mass executions, torture on a large scale, and repeated deadly attacks on civilians. The Syrian population was trapped between the regime, rebel groups, and religious extremists. A third of the Syrian people have been displaced within Syria, while over 4 million have fled the country. The vast majority of them reside now in camps in the neighboring countries, who are taking care of 95% of the refugees, while the Arab states of the Persian Gulf together have accepted zero Syrian refugees, which has been called especially shameful by Amnesty International. The UN and the World Food Programme were not prepared for a refugee crisis on this scale. As a result, many refugee camps are crowded and undersupplied, subjecting people to cold, hunger, and disease. The Syrians lost hope that their situation will be getting better anytime soon, so many decided to seek asylum in Europe. Between 2007 and 2014, the European Union had invested about 2 billion euros in defences, high-tech security technology, and border patrols, but not a lot in preparation for an influx of refugees, so it was badly prepared for the storm of asylum seekers. In the EU, a refugee has to stay in the state they arrived in first, which put enormous pressure on the border states that were already in trouble. Greece, in the midst of an economic crisis on the scale of the Great Depression, was not able to take care of so many people at once, leading to terrible scenes of desperate, hungry people on islands usually reserved for tourists. The world needed to come together and act as a united front, but instead, it has become more divided. Many states downright refused to take in any refugees, leaving the border states alone in their struggle. In 2014, the UK lobbied to stop a huge search and rescue operation called Mare Nostrum that was designed to stop asylum seekers from drowning in the Mediterranean. The idea seems to have been that a higher death toll on the sea would mean fewer asylum seekers trying to make the journey. But of course, in reality, that's not what happened. The crisis around the world suddenly changed when photos circulated of a dead boy from Syria found lying face down on a beach in Turkey. Germany announced that it will, without exception, accept all Syrian refugees and is now preparing to take in 800,000 people in 2015, more than the entire EU took in 2014, only to impose temporary border controls a few days later and demand an EU-wide solution. All over the West, more and more people are beginning to take action, although support for asylum seekers has mostly come from citizens, not from politicians. But there are fears in the Western world. Islam, high birth rates, crime, and the collapse of the social systems. Let's acknowledge this and look at the facts. Even if the EU alone were to accept all 4 million Syrian refugees and 100% of them were Muslims, the percentage of Muslims in the European Union would only rise from about 4% to about 5%. This is not a drastic change and will certainly not make it a Muslim continent. A Muslim minority is neither new nor reason to be afraid. Birth rates in many parts of the Western world are low, so some fear asylum seekers might overtake the native population in a few decades. Studies have shown that even though birth rates are higher among Muslims in Europe, they drop and adjust as the standard of living and level of education rises. Most Syrian refugees already are educated. The birth rate in Syria before the civil war was not very high, and the population was actually shrinking, not growing. The fear that refugees lead to higher crime rates also turns out to be wrong. Refugees who become immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than the native population. When allowed to work, they tend to start businesses and integrate themselves into the workforce as fast as possible, paying more into the social system than they extract from them. Syrians coming to the West are potential professional workers, desperately needed to sustain Europe's aging population. Also, refugees traveling with smartphones has led to the misconception that they're not really in need of help. Social media and the internet have become a vital part of being a refugee. GPS is used to navigate the long routes to Europe. Facebook groups give tips and information about obstacles in real time. This only proves that these people are like us. If you had to make a dangerous journey, would you leave your phone behind? The European Union is the wealthiest bunch of economies on Earth. Well-organized states with functioning social systems, infrastructure, democracy, and huge industries. It can handle the challenge of the refugee crisis if it wants to. The same can be said for the whole Western world. But while tiny Jordan has taken in over 600,000 Syrian refugees, the UK, which has 78 times the GDP of Jordan, has only said it will allow 20,000 Syrians across its borders over the next 5 years. The US has agreed to accept 10,000, Australia 12,000 people. Overall, things are slowly getting better, but not fast enough. We are writing history right now. How do we want to be remembered? As xenophobic rich cows behind fences. We have to realize that these people fleeing death and destruction are no different from us. By accepting them into our countries and integrating them into our societies, we have much to gain. There is only something to be lost if we ignore this crisis. More dead children are sure to wash ashore if we don't act with humanity and reason. Let's do this right and try to be the best we possibly can be.
Okay, so that gives kind of a really brief overview of what was going on in Greece and why there were, why there are so many people there, why they're stuck there, and the situation of great peril that brought them there. I want to just kind of move the map over here. This is a terrible map, by the way. but it does give a little bit of a glimpse of where we were and where the refugee crisis was begun. And a lot of the people that we met were from the city of Aleppo. And they had to cross all of this journey, either by land or by water, to get all the way to Athens. I do want to kind of have a quick moment to kind of sum up a little bit. We just have a few minutes left. But to go back to my first point about Micah, the prophet, telling us what does the Lord require of you, and to do three things, that we are called to do justice, we are called to love mercy, and we are called to walk humbly with our God. In the two teams that went, our work was basically to do those three things. And so the next 2 weeks are going to be us talking about how we did that, how we did justice, how we loved mercy, and how we walked humbly. how we tried to be missionaries in a different way than a lot of the rest of Christian history, that we tried to bring a new narrative to a place of great, great pain and to build relationships. We were there to not necessarily be Santa Claus and to solve the problem. We were there to offer aid as we could, but really to learn and to bring back our own stories of what we experienced and our own relationships that we continue now. A lot of us have friended people on Facebook and, you know, hear updates via email and text from a lot of the people that we met. And I also want to say that, you know, when you go on mission, you never go alone. You never go as just, this is just me being a good person, having a personal motivation to do that. You bring your tribes wherever you go, even if you're by yourself. So you bring the community that supported you financially or otherwise to get there. You bring St. Paul's Church. You bring your own perspectives, and you can never check those things at the door. In fact, they become a part of the mission. And so when we are considering what we're there to do, we are considering what kind of baggage go with those tribes. And we seek to try to set up the relationship so that we can understand one another. That my concept of family might be different from this refugee's concept of family. My sense of church, my sense of belonging to friendship, all the tribes that I'm a part of, I'm bringing that and also trying to get to know how another person could see their own belonging to tribes. And that the interesting thing in this crisis, all of their sense of belonging to any group has been shattered, has been completely disrupted. And for us to provide stability and relationship, but also to provide a sense of what was it like before the war? Let's talk about that. Let's figure out what that was like so that they're able to, you know, reclaim and call to mind the way in which they belong. They still belong and they still matter. I want to do a little brief introduction before we conclude of all the people that went on the trip so that if any people in the room want to ask questions directly to people, and I'm not sure who all's here, Don Brown and Megan Foster are not here, Nancy Montgomery there in the back, Ruth Prongay is not here, Debbie Clark here in the front row, Megan Marshall Wicker right there, Hunter Thomas on the back row, Catherine Vernon, and Sally Dudley, and myself, and my husband, who can't be here on Sunday mornings. We are all, and Jack Fleer, I'm so sorry. I missed you. Sorry about that. So we are the people that represent this ministry. If you have questions and want to engage with people individually, you can do that. Next week, we're going to be talking a little bit about the refugee camps that are in Athens, what life is like there, and what is the life of the refugees like. And so some of the people on the trip will have a chance to speak. The next week, we're going to talk a little bit about other agencies that we served, other ways that there are helpers on the ground beyond the camps, and there will be some people that will speak then. So thank you all for listening and being a part of this. Are there any last-minute questions? I think we're running out of time. And yeah. The video, let me go back to that. It was produced by the UN Refugee Agency. Why is it doing that? Yeah, I found it on YouTube and Vimeo, yeah. And I think all I did was, if you just put in the search, Refugee Crisis Explained. That's the title of it. That's a very good question. There's a lot of fear. Her question was, the part of the video you saw, there are Arab countries near to Syria that have taken in no refugees, like Saudi Arabia and Oman and Yemen and all of those areas that are farther south. The reason really is, the most simple answer to that is there's fear involved with the different rebel groups that are fighting this war and with some of the different religious circles that are there. It's very sad that that's happening. Yes. Yes, Sue.
So, is there a
That's right. So Sue is asking about the bringing up the difference between refugees and immigrants. And refugees are people who are seeking asylum because their country is in a period of war, in a period of discrimination, a period of fear. Immigrants are people who are not in that situation. And yet there is a lot of discrimination of these two groups in the United States in particular. And that's an important nuance, I think, because we were going and serving people who were not wanting to leave Syria. They would have loved to stay there. They would have loved to keep their life there. There are even a few people who stayed, which at their own peril were in this very rough situation. Everyone that is in this crisis is there because they have been forced out. And yeah, that's an important thing to bring up. So I have to run and go get ready for worship, but y'all hang out and talk. Thank you all, and I'll see you next week.